This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture. I'm PJ Thumb and I'm a historian from the University of Oxford. And this is the history of Singapore. Episode 22, De Tocqueville in Singapore. Alexis de Tocqueville, the great French political thinker and historian, who's best known for his work, Democracy in America, wrote, quote, "The freedom of association is a vital safeguard against the tyranny of the majority. And where such associations do not exist, and individuals are unable to create something like them artificially or temporarily, there is, as far as I can see, no longer a barrier holding back any sort of tyranny, and a great nation may be oppressed with impunity by a fistful of rebels, or even a single man." He wrote this after traveling through an 1830s America that, like Singapore over a century later, was undergoing economic, social, and political transformation. Technology was transforming the organization of labor and its relationship to capital. Democratic participation was expanding and ending the monopolization of government by elites. Like 19th century Americans, the vast majority of Singapore's people learned from birth that they could not rely on government for any assistance and regarded the authorities with anything from apathy to mistrust and anxiety, if they regarded the authorities at all. De Tocqueville's positive account of associationalism, quote, "stressed volunteerism, community spirit, and independent associational life as protections against the domination of society by the state, and indeed as a counterbalance which helped to keep the state accountable and effective," end quote. By the 1930s, Singapore's society was already internally organized into highly politicized mutual associations. Over the course of this series, I've described how these associations were founded. Through the need for internal government and regulation, such as the secret societies in the 1800s, or later the guilds and clan associations in the late 1800s, or to promote the interests of a community, such as the Persekutuan Islam Singapura, which was founded around 1900 to promote the interests of the Muslim community in Singapore, and then the Muslim Institute in 1921 to promote Malay interests against Arab and Persian and Indian dominance, and then the Kesatuan Melayu Singapura, founded in 1926 as an early political party. And then, of course, there were the religious organizations, the Christian missionary societies, the All-Malaya Muslim Missionary Society, Muhammadiyah, and then later trade unions and student organizations, and of course, throughout this whole period, cultural organizations, sporting societies, etc., etc., etc. And if you think for a minute that any of these societies were not political, then clearly you've never been a member of an association in Singapore. Politics comes naturally to Singaporeans like breathing. Join any organization in Singapore today, religious, sporting, cultural, even your local school's parents' association, and everyone's ridiculously political. Since the 1930s at least, if not further back, we have been a hyper-politicized society organized around associations which competed internally and externally between its members and between each other in recognition of the fact that we had to look after ourselves and organize ourselves for common interests because Singapore's government was not going to do a thing to help us. I've said it before and I'll say it again, there is nothing more central to the Singapore identity than self-help, than getting things done without waiting around for the government or some other authority to step in and take care of it. We are the people who get things done. And in an environment in which politics remained heavily circumscribed, where the power of politicians in the legislative assembly was very limited, there was not much political parties could do. Lee Kuan Yew recognized this in 1955 when he argued that the Rendell Constitution was unworkable, that it was basically a poison chalice, that elected ministers were being given responsibility without being given the power to actually do anything, that they were being set up to fail and take the blame, deflecting criticism from the British colonial authorities. He had a point. Although perhaps he overstated the British intent, the Rendell Constitution was also a product of internal compromise among the British, between those who wanted to push forward and give more democracy and those who wanted to pull back and protect what the British had. And so, like most things produced by committee, it's neither here nor there. But the scary thing is that the Rendell Constitution is still the same constitution we operate today. Despite Lee Kuan Yew's promises in 1965 that we would get a new constitution, we still use the Rendell Constitution, heavily amended, of course, but we still use a colonial constitution designed to promote colonial interests and, most crucially, to limit the power of Singaporeans to govern ourselves. Have you ever wondered why constitutional amendments don't require a referendum? Because fundamentally, it's a colonial constitution which does not want to consult the people. So I've asked before and I ask again, are we still a colonial country? So anyway, in 1955, the political arena was heavily circumscribed. At the same time, Singapore's communities were heavily politicized because of all their associations. So for Singaporeans, it was a natural step to expand them beyond the community and turn them towards national issues to prevent domination by the colonial state. As we've discussed in the past few episodes, the success of the Nantar campaign demonstrated the viability of an issues-based mass movement. Its success in the teeth of colonial resistance catalyzed the growth of further associations and movements. The subsequent events of the riot squad brutally beats up unarmed students on 13th May 1954 incident, also known as the National Service Protest, led to a rebirth of student activism. The lifting of severe restrictions on the trade union activity following the election of the Labour Front government led to the events of the Hockley bus strike and riot. Now, following Hockley, the colonial authorities did not stand idly by. They aimed to respond firmly to the next strike, and this turned out to be the Singapore Harbour Board Staff Association strike. The dispute between the Singapore Harbour Board and its staff association was by far the largest labour dispute in Singapore in terms of sheer worker numbers, and had been going on since 1952. The Singapore Harbour Board was protected by its status as a semi-official body critical to the economy. And so the board freely ignored the staff association demands and reneged on verbal agreements with impunity. On the 1st of April 1955, 1,300 members of the staff association, generally representing clerical staff, voted to strike. The strike began the 1st of May and dragged on for over a month with no resolution, but it was also overshadowed by Hockley. On the 8th of June, after the end of Hockley, Lim Chin Siong backed up his talk of labour unity by announcing, somewhat unexpectedly, that the Singapore Factory and Shopworkers Union and its allied unions would go on strike for one day on the 13th of June in sympathy with the Singapore Harbour Board Staff Association if the government did not intervene to settle the dispute. 2 days later, the Singapore Bus Workers Union and the Federation of Coastal Workers issued the same threat. The recently massively increased size of both unions threatened a devastating effect on Singapore's public transport infrastructure. Now, the staff association reacted cautiously to this offer of union solidarity. It was a white-collar, English-speaking union, not a natural ally of the predominantly blue-collar, Chinese-led Factory and Shopworkers Union and Bus Workers Union. Its general secretary, Jamit Singh, was cautious about being caught up in PAP politics. David Marshall, the chief minister, met with union leaders Lim Chin Siong, Devan Nair, and S. Woodhull on the 10th of June. He urged them to help him settle the conflict, and they agreed. The next day, one of them met with Jamit Singh and urged him to call off the strike. Singh refused. With no news that the strike was being called off, and mindful of the recent events of Hockley, the British authorities resolved to head off any possible violence by preemptively arresting around 200 trade unionists. Remember that at this time the British, not the elected ministers, controlled the security services, the police, the military. David Marshall urged moderation, and he quickly sought another meeting of Lim Chin Siong, who arrived with David Nair and S. Woodhull within an hour. Marshall accused them of breaking their promise. They explained that they had tried to convincing to call off his strike, but were unable to. Marshall proposed that, okay, they cancel the proposed sympathy strike, and he, in return, would get the Singapore Harbour Board to reopen negotiations with the Singapore Harbour Board Staff Association and see that the latter obtain a fair deal. The unionists quickly agreed, and by 9:20 p.m., a statement calling a meeting of trade unions to consider calling off the sympathy strike was issued. The agreement reached was broadcast over the radio the same night and published in the newspapers the next morning. Now, David Marshall left the meeting with Lim, Devan Nair and Woodhull to ask the British to call off their arrests. And he went back and forth twice between the meeting and the British before finally returning to inform Lim and his associates that the British would not endorse the agreement. The British still intended to take punitive action against them. The British thought David Marshall's handling of the Hockley riots was, quote-unquote, excessively soft. They thought he had excessive sympathy for workers and students and rejected his judgment. Still, Marshall managed to convince the British to limit the punitive action to just 7 arrests instead of the, quote, truncheons and bullets, unquote, that they desired. So over the night of 11th to 12th June, Special Branch arrested Bus Workers Union leader Fong Swee Suan and 7 other trade union leaders and raided the premises of the Singapore Factory and Shop Workers Union, which was also at the time the temporary headquarters of the People's Action Party. Having heard that the arrest had been called off, rank and file unionists were furious at this perceived treachery. The Bus Workers Union called an emergency meeting at noon and decided to strike from 2 p.m. The next day, the Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union and Federation of Coastal Workers joined them. And in total, 15,765 workers at 79 factories and shops struck. 24 unions held a meeting at the Factory and Shop Workers Union premises on the 15th of June and released a joint statement demanding that the detained trade unionists be put on trial or released. A number of smaller unions also put out statements asking for the government to step in and help resolve the situation. The pro-government Singapore Trade Union Congress, Lim Yew Hock's allies, remained neutral. They declined to support the strike, but they did not endorse the government's actions either. And as usual, Lee Kuan Yew was two-faced. Publicly, he condemned the arrest. Privately, he called Marshall, quote, feeble and lamentable in the extreme, unquote, from having restrained Special Branch from making all 200 detentions. The police quickly put out a statement on the Monday that the trade unionists were communists and had been arrested under emergency regulations. The trade unions replied, prove it. If Special Branch had evidence, they should put the men on trial in open court. If not, the men should be released. Under pressure from Marshall, the police released one man and formally charged another. And this prompt action partially mollified public opinion. On the 16th of June, Marshall announced that the cases of the detainees would be fully considered within 2 weeks in accordance with the emergency regulations. Satisfied, Lim Chin Siong called off the strike. However, he warned that the strike would be resumed if his colleagues were not released or brought to trial within a fortnight as promised. Marshall kept his word. 3 more men were released by 24th June, Fong Swee Suan was released in July, and Chen Yang Cheng in October. Lo Wah Lim of the Malayan Textile Workers Union was tried in court and convicted of possession of Malayan Communist Party documents and proscribed publications. This outcome was accepted by the unions. This outcome was a watershed. Never before had people detained under emergency regulations been released from prison so quickly. Never before had the government limited itself to the letter of its own law. I know it seems amazing to you, but in the colonial period, and especially during the Malayan emergency, the government often did not consider itself bound by its own law. It acted with impunity, and often could simply change the law to suit itself or simply just ignore the law altogether. But that's the nature of a colonial government. And now, for the first time, The government was acting fairly and transparently. This was regarded as a minor miracle. And these events spurred a new hope for democracy and human rights in Singapore. In June, the new labor ordinance passed. It made a number of basic improvements in workers' rights, allowing workers to claim up to 4 months arrears in pay, reduced the workday limit from 9 to 8 hours, and introduced a 44-hour work week. The legislation, introduced by the government just 2 months into office, was a clear improvement on the status quo. Although, of course, internally, the British colonial officials complained about it. Meanwhile, the Harbour Board Staff Association strike ended peacefully. Jamit Singh reached a 15-point final agreement on 7th July at the Ministry of Labour after 100 hours of negotiation. It gave the Staff Association wage increases as well as shorter working hours and cost the Harbour Board a total sum of $11,500. Jamit Singh was jubilant, calling the agreement, quote, a great victory for the trade union movement of this country, unquote. The end of the strike was marked by ceremonial slaughter of 7 goats in accordance with the upcoming Muslim holiday. David Marshall had been chief minister for just over 2 months, but already it seemed like the world had changed. The victory of the Harbour Board Staff Association indicated that workers might actually have a chance of being treated fairly from now on. Meanwhile, the prompt processing of the detainees, in accordance with the law, gave the people of Singapore new hope that there would be rule of law in the country. Rule of law. We take it for granted today, but under a colonial government, which is not responsible to the people of Singapore, rule of law was never guaranteed. The David Marshall era was utterly different from what had come before, and it gave people a new feeling. A strange feeling, an unexpected feeling, a feeling which no other leader of Singapore before or since has ever inspired so fiercely. David Marshall gave people hope. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm PJ Thum. If you've just joined us, welcome to this week's episode of The History of Singapore, De Tocqueville in Singapore. Following the watershed events of April to July 1955, legitimate left-wing activity was no longer repressed, and the government would observe the law and seek to be impartial. Thus, 1955 to 56 would see a flowering of mass movements and associationalism in Singapore. The events surrounding these movements became the defining events in the political development of Singapore. This period is perhaps the peak of broad-based democracy in Singapore, before the colonial government and its successor systematically closed off mass participation in the political process. So, in the wake of all these events, mutual associations sprang up in areas which experienced colonial discrimination. This included among rural residents, Chinese culture, and education. But let's keep with labor first, which was, after all, the main area of exploitation and discrimination. Inspired by the success of the Factory and Shop Workers Union and the Bus Workers Union and other allied unions, workers clustered together into trade unions to negotiate for better terms. Unions sprang up in individual companies, affiliated themselves to a national industry-wide union, and the industrial unions came together in an umbrella national union congress. This was a pattern akin to the traditional structure of political organization in Singapore. Like the mutual help associations, they also performed social welfare roles, providing unemployment relief, mediating in family disputes, and even witnessing weddings. So these unions are also innovative. They bring together new ideas of labor and class and politics with older established conceptions of social, economic, and political organization in Singapore. In this highly competitive and labor-friendly environment, the unions were spectacularly successful. Indeed, the Department of Labor admitted that in most instances, workers were genuinely being exploited and so, quote, concessions were inevitable, unquote. To the dismay of Labor Department officials, these successful structures and methods were quickly imitated by other unions, including Kuomintang-sponsored anti-communist unions and pro-government Singapore Trade Union Congress unions. But these unions often failed to match the results of the group of unions known as the Middle Road Group. It was referred to as such because many of them had their head offices on that street. And the group was anchored by the Singapore Factory and Shop Workers Union, led by Lim Chin Siong. The new governor, Sir Robert Brown Black, yes, that was his real name, observed, quote, a familiar pattern, unquote. Once a union affiliated to Middle Road, Lim Chin Siong or Devan Nair or another Middle Road trade union leader would organize the negotiations, while Lee Kuan Yew or Tan Wee Tiong made legal threats, leading to a massive union victory. And so, with these leaders, these legends of Singapore at the helm, by 1956, disputes at locally owned firms were generally being resolved fairly smoothly and easily, with workers gaining more equitable treatment. A Nanyang Shangbao survey in September 1955 found that workers at Chinese bus companies were now decently paid and generally satisfied, which was amazing because workers at Chinese bus companies were previously some of the most exploited and unhappy workers in Singapore. Public enthusiasm for the labor movement reached a new high. Workers joined unions in droves. The number of unions rose from 136 to 187, and the number of union members nearly doubled from 76,452 to 139,317. On the back of its spectacular performances, the Singapore Factory and Shop Workers Union membership rose from a mere 273 in February 1955 when Lim Chin Siong was elected as the Secretary General to a staggering 30,000 in just 10 months. Special Branch actually wrote in one of its reports on the trade union movement, quote, nothing succeeds like success, unquote. But there was no reason to limit these methods to labor organizations. All these new organizations that were formed throughout 55, 56, springing up around issues and common concerns and sharing leaders and members and expertise, all use these methods as well. In response to the assault on Chinese culture, groups devoted to Chinese arts and education and school alumni organizations, which had cultural and social and recreational components, as well as, of course, the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students Union, were created. By March 1956, there were at least 77 Chinese cultural organizations in Singapore with a total of around 15,000 members. And of course, groups would seek Lim Chin Siong and Devan Nair to advise in their organization and hire Lee Kuan Yew or Tan Wee Tiong as their legal representative. That was the winning formula. Numerous associations following this winning formula formed or tried to form throughout 1955, including the Singapore Farmers Association, Singapore Women's Association, Singapore Chinese Schools Parents Association, the Wooden House Dwellers Association, the Singapore Itinerant Hawkers and Stallholders Association, the Federation of Singapore Chinese Schools Old Boys Association, the Chinese Primary Schools Teachers Association, Federation of Chinese Schools Old Boys Association, Singapore Unemployment Service, Malay Students League, and of course, numerous trade unions. In July 1955, a mass meeting attended by 53 organizations representing approximately 28,000 Malays in Singapore unanimously approved a Malay education plan and formed the Majlis Pelajaran Melayu, or Malay Education Council, to protest the British colonial Malay education policy. Its leaders were left-wing Malay nationalists, many of whom were former PKMM members. A letter of support from the Singapore Chinese Middle School Student Union was warmly welcomed and read out by the MEC chairman, Harun bin Mohammed Amin. And of course, the political parties also followed this pattern, and especially the PAP. We think today of the PAP as Lee Kuan Yew's party, but it wasn't, not until 1957. In this period, between its founding in 54 and 1956, it was chiefly a trade union coalition organized by Lim Chin Siong and Devan Nair, advised and represented in the assembly by a political appendage led by Lee Kuan Yew. Remember, this is a period where politics was circumscribed, so the politicians could not be the people who were effecting change, who were making concrete progress. It was the trade unionists. The unions, not the political party, were the more valuable and productive aspect of the coalition. It was the unions who were making life better for the people of Singapore. The unions enabled the party's political success, which was not just because of the union's success, which didn't just ride on the back of the union's success, but also was successful in the polls because of the organizational capabilities of the trade unions and Chinese students who would organize the rallies and get voters to the polls. And where was the PAP temporary headquarters? Middle Road. It was housed in the Singapore Factory and Shopworkers Union headquarters, which provided secretarial and support and temporary housing to a wide range of incipient new organizations, of which the PAP was one. The PAP's main offices were not moved until the June special branch raid, which I mentioned just now, made the party realize it had better not put all its eggs in one basket. And of course, Lee Kuan Yew hated being the junior partner in the coalition. He asked Lim Chin Siong and Devan Nair not to stand for re-election to the PAP Central Executive Committee at its first anniversary in 1955. They agreed to keep Lee happy, but also possibly because the unions mattered so much more than the political party. The unions didn't need the party so much as the party needed the unions. And unsurprisingly, secret British correspondence from this time notes that Lee Kuan Yew was already dropping hints to colonial officials that they should curtail Lim and Nair's quote-unquote extremist policies. This is November 1955. And the British are still firmly in power, and Lee is already sabotaging his comrades. Other political parties were forced to adapt. As the Middle Road PAP coalition gained ascendancy, UMNO Singapore's progressive left wing, which was pro-PAP, espousing a non-communal united front, struggled with its conservative Malay nationalist right wing, which was pro-federation, pro-UMNO in the federation, for control of party policy, while UMNO Singapore's president, Abdul Hamid bin Jumaat, struggled to bridge the differences between his left and right. But change was inevitable. For example, UMNO had an official policy of not participating in the labour movement, but it quickly found that it had to get involved in labour to have any chance. No legitimate political party could hope to win the popular vote without being on the side of the workers. So, despite its official policy of not participating in the labour movement, UMNO would collect funds to support, for example, the Harbour Board Staff Association strikers. And at its annual general meeting on the 2nd of October 1955, it revoked the policy entirely and established a welfare and labour department. It promptly took a leaf out of the Chinese Cultural Association's playbook by organising a play to raise money for a strike fund. The police refused to license it without seeing a complete script, and the idea was dropped. The Labour Front, on the other hand, had the opposite problem to UMNO. It already had strong labour links. It was already firmly in control of the Singapore Trade Union Congress by Lim Yew Hock. But as a political coalition thrown together to contest the election, they lacked any real political party, any form of party structure, and so had to quickly begin building one. Meanwhile, the Progressive Party and Democrat parties merged to form the Liberal Socialist Party. Yes, the most right-wing conservative party in Singapore was named the Liberal Socialist Party. It clearly demonstrates what the electorate wanted. And so, along the same lines as everyone else, the Liberal Socialist Party immediately tried to organize over 50 registered societies into an amalgamated association. Other right-wing associations in this time included the Singapore Citizenship Rights Association, a Writers Association, and a Students' Federation. In the official Singapore story, the existence of the Chinese cultural associations and trade unions and their structure and their methods and the activity and, you know, such as fundraising events and social events like picnics and their pro-labor activities are usually presented as evidence that these associations were pro-communist. But this is a red herring. The fact is that associational democracy flowered in Singapore between 1955 and 56 for a much simpler reason. Because it worked. Associations were the best, the most effective way to organize. They brought together people with common interests into a single group who could then represent those interests and fight for change and resist British discrimination. This is where we have our first mass political movements formed around coalitions of common political interests who grouped together to fight for change and to resist British oppression. Associations worked. And that's why associations became commonplace. Their organization, structures and activities became commonplace. Everyone and their dog started or joined an association. And they followed the same structure because that's what worked. Why reinvent the wheel? They copied each other shamelessly. Successful innovations by any one association were quickly duplicated across the board. And this included events. Associations in general had limited resources and needed fundraising. So they organized fundraising events. And they could only afford cost-effective activities like picnics. Because, you know, you don't need to rent a location. You just go to the beach or go to any park or any open space and have a picnic. And the fact that right-wing associations or UMNO Singapore or MCA Singapore also did these demonstrates just how widespread this practice was. And when it comes down to it, 1955 to 56 was a triumph of associational democracy because in a time when the colonial authority was still overwhelmingly powerful and many other legitimate forms of politics were circumscribed, democratic associationalism was what was helping Singaporeans make life better for themselves. It was the most successful form of politics in Singapore. It worked. And nothing succeeds like success. Now, all this took place against the backdrop of a new spirit of Afro-Asian internationalism and democratic self-determination. Singapore's anti-colonial movement would be infused with these new ideas and new spirit. Their leaders would seek to turn the theory of Afro-Asian solidarity into practice. It is the meeting in Bandung in April 1955 which transforms Singapore's anti-colonial movement. It would broaden debate about the nature of nationalism and colonialism and help Singapore's anti-colonial activists form a consensus over their vision for a post-colonial Malayan identity and state. And this would fundamentally transform the nature of the anti-colonial movement in Singapore, bringing it into direct confrontation with the colonial authorities. So we will pick up with the story of Bandung in 2 weeks' time. Next week, we bring you a special episode, an interview with Dr. Po Soo Kai. Dr. Po Soo Kai was president of the University of Malaya Socialist Club in 1955 and its secretary general in 1956. He was a member of the 8-person editorial board of the Socialist Club newsletter, Faja, who were charged by the colonial government with sedition in 1954. He was also a founding member of the People's Action Party in 1954 and was later the assistant secretary general of the Barisan Socialists when it was established in 1961. In 1963, he was detained without trial under Operation Cold Store and was held for a total of 17 years. He has recently published his memoir called Living in a Time of Deception, which will be launched in Singapore on Saturday, 13 February at 2 p.m. at the Holiday Inn Atrium on Outram Road. So we hope you will join us next week for this exclusive interview. As always, if you have any questions, comments or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the show, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. See you next week. This has been The History of Singapore, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.